Hello, everybody. This is Marshall Poe. I'm the founder and editor of the New Books Network. I've published several academic books, and one of the things I found frustrating is my inability to get them picked up in the press. There really is no PR service specifically oriented toward academic books. Recently, however, I had the opportunity to work with a PR firm in New York, RLM, on a book that I recently published. And I have to say, they did a remarkable job at a very low price. And this got me thinking. I wonder if the New Books Network and RLM could provide a service that would promote academic books. So the folks at RLM and I put our heads together and we came up with a package. It is specifically targeted toward people like you, people who write academic books. So if you're interested, you should go to the NBN website and click publish. Publicize your book, and there you'll find some information about the services that the NBN and RLM are offering. What we really want to do is provide you with value for money. As far as we know, no such service exists. This is the first of its kind, and we really hope it is successful, and we hope that it helps you get the word out about your academic book.
Welcome to the New Books Network.
Hello, Can Okçuoğlu from American University in Washington, D.C. And I'm very happy to launch the Kurdish study series of New Books Network. Today we have our first guest, Dr. Zeynep Kaya, who is based in London teaching at SOAS. And she is also affiliated with London School of Economics and Cambridge University. She's also editor of Kurdish series. Affiliated with London School of Economics Middle East Center. Welcome, Zeynep.
Hi, Dilan.
We are very happy to have you. We are going to talk about your book, which you have recently released from Cambridge University Press. It's called Mapping Kurdistan, Territory, Self-Determination, and Nationalism. Let's start with some general questions, Zeynep. Actually, I was curious about the story behind this book. So can you tell us about your intellectual history and how that history informs your interests in studying Kurds and Kurdistan through the lens of debates on territory, self-determination, and nationalism?
Thank you, Dilan. First, thank you for having me on this podcast, and congratulations on the launch of the podcast. So the question of intellectual history, I think, is in my case very much connected to my personal history. So I grew up in Turkey, and I'm from Van, which is at the border of Iran, and very close to the border, basically. And we lived there for about 4 years, and then we had to move elsewhere after the military coup. But then we obviously stayed in contact. You know, we always went and visited our family there, and etc. So growing up elsewhere, but being from Eastern Turkey or Kurdistan, I've been always, you know, been asking, you know, where are you from? Oh, so you're from Kurdistan, or are you Kurdish, or you're not Kurdish? So these types of identity issues, especially during that time when I was growing up in the 1980s, were quite prominent. The PKK had just launched its conflict, you know, the war against the Turkish government. So the political environment was very tense, and etc. So I grew up in that environment, and my father was very political. He was always kind of discussing these things with his friends, and there was always some political issue being, you know, having been discussed in the house, books and everything. You know, from a young age, I became very much interested in politics. I always wanted to study politics from a young age. And the things that I read and the things that were discussed around me, I guess, informed that kind of desire. So I basically studied then international relations and politics, and then I really enjoyed the research side of things. And I wasn't sure about going into the employment sector, so I wanted to further study. So I did a master's, and then I really enjoyed that process, and I decided to do a PhD. And doing PhD abroad during that time, so this was early 2000s, and it was still a bit of a difficult time to work on the Kurds in Turkey. So I did my PhD in the UK, so and I always wanted to study on the issue of Kurds. So being abroad also gave me the opportunity to pursue that that goal. Basically, that's kind of the background in my interest about my interest in Kurdish and Kurds and Kurdish studies.
Yeah.
And territoriality. Yep. Go ahead.
So I think the most intriguing part of your research is your focus on the connection between territory and people. And while you do that, you also make it clear that you want to go beyond state-centering perspectives, because I think that it kind of dominates the field of international relations. And actually, the case in political theory or international law is not so different from international relations, because the questions of territory and territoriality has been significantly neglected. Why do you think this is the case?
Mm-hmm. I think, it's kind of my interest in the identity between, you know, people and territories. Actually, again, I think I should have to go back to my, when growing up in Turkey, especially, people ask you where you're from, and then they associate it's kind of your identity, your political position, so on and so forth, with where you are from, the location that you're from. So that was, and being from Eastern Turkey and then not living there. So, I'm from this region, they would immediately say, oh, so you're kind of, you're Kurdish, or you're this, or you're that. So there's a lot of categorization, the geographical imagination of identities, which, you know, is a very complex process, identity formation, and very much neglects the idea that, you know, people can choose their identity, can shape their political affiliations. You know, they are not bound by where they are born, who they are born to, what type of family they are born to, or ethnic, linguistic, other types of indicators. So I've always been quite puzzled by how much these naturally seen indicators of identity are taken so much for granted, and territory is one of them. In Turkey, the idea of nationalism, nationality is very prominent. You know, the Turkish state boundaries is always kind of seen as sacred. It's a very state, very traditional kind of state understanding of state, and then we imagine everyone within those boundaries as belonging to a particular identity. So intellectually, these were never fully made sense to me. And I wanted to question that. And I've always been interested in maps and these territorial imaginations of identities, map drawing, and so on and so forth. So that also was another kind of reason why I pursued this. But I basically wanted to question the taken for grantedness of territory, and also the gap in the literature on the concept of territory, as you said, is quite, it's changing now, but it was particularly the case when I started my PhD. And in the case of Kurds, despite territory and territoriality, territorial imagination being such a central notion in the construction of Kurdish nationalism and historiography, it hasn't been studied almost at all. So I wanted to also pursue that and do something that would contribute to the literature. on this
Definitely,
topic.
And I think it's a very significant contribution, given that there's a huge gap in the literature, especially when we look at the Growing Kurdish Studies literature, but also the broader literature of international relations. So, but despite that, the number of dissertations, articles, and books focusing on the territorial, like focusing on the question of territory, both its theoretical and empirical dimensions have been growing. In political theory, we know there is Margaret Moore, David Miller. They are looking at the question of territory, but also territorial rights, who belong to where and who is entitled to that particular territory, especially in terms of conflicting interest. On the other hand, we have those comparative, more empirical studies looking at the question of secession, self-determination. And I think in your book, you actually connect these different kinds of discussions, ongoing discussions on the question. That's why it is something difficult to do. That's why it is a kind of multidisciplinary work, which lies at the intersection of different fields. But I'm wondering, Zeynep, I'm wondering where you prefer to create your book within this broader picture.
I mean, Dilan, you're absolutely right. It's an interdisciplinary work, and again, like, you know, it's kind of, I don't want to categorize it in a way that it's particularly in this field or that field, because it's very hard to do that, because it belongs to multiple. I benefited from insights, intellectual, analytical, theoretical, conceptual insights, empirical insights from all those disciplinary perspectives you just mentioned. They all informed the work, and that's one of the reasons I ended up dropping on somehow. When I started working, I was very much focusing on IR and the Kurds, but the more I started to go into the issue of identity, a construction of identity, territory, I ended up diving into political geography, nationalism, literature. And then also the work ended up becoming very historical. So I also started to, have a historical approach. It turned into a book that it's impossible to allocate where it is, where it's home discipline. And I think in the process, I've also lost my own home discipline. I don't know which discipline I belong to now. So I teach IR. It's a familiar background for me. But at the same time, I do political sociology, historical sociology, so on and so forth. So I think it's a historical sociology is a very strong element for sure in my work as an approach. To understanding how in the long term processes, political processes change, and how they are changing in interaction with the changing international relations. So therefore, international relations is also very, very central. So I would say international relations and historical sociology are the main things. And it's funny, I keep coming back to those themes in my work. When I did my master's in Turkey, and my master's dissertation was international historical sociology of international relations. So that's when I first met with this kind of approach, and I think that really shaped my general understanding of things. So very abstract, very hardcore IR theories don't fully, in my opinion, explain things, as if they lack the flesh, the empirical. Information and historical sociology, I think, gives me an ability to have this historical, empirical, but long-term kind of generalizable information. So Yeah, so that's where I am basically. It has a very general approach, obviously. It's very long term, so I don't go into detail into too much on the case studies, or in the history of the Kurdish nationalism, history of the Kurdish politics. So it's a very broad overlook. So therefore, it still has IR elements, I think, in terms of
yes, definitely
understanding yeah the interaction. Yeah, so. Very long answer to your very good question is, I guess, yeah, IR and historical sociology would be the main kind of...
Also, Zeynep, I think we need this kind of contributions, especially within the field of IR. I mean, we need this kind of challenges coming from the inside of the discipline, who, like, especially from those scholars who know the jargon, the basics of the literature and IR, but also who can go beyond that so that help us to understand the connections between IR, but also other subfields in political science and sociology. That's why it is a kind of, this book is kind of very rich in terms of reconsidering the contours, the limits of those kind of subfields at the same time, I guess. So if you go back to the previous question, I want to give you a little more time, especially to elaborate further on the main contributions of your work to these literatures, both IR, Kurdish studies, political geography, as you said.
Mm-hmm. So I think in my main starting point for this thesis, and that's I think remain a key focus, is to bring the study of Kurds, the case of Kurds, into the study of international relations. As a case, it hasn't been utilized or used in IR, and I think it's a very rich case, and it helps question a lot of concepts in IR or help us explore the empirical implications of the theory. It's a complex case. It's a non-state case. It very much challenges the state level explanations. And then it's a case in which there has been a strong element of desire to form a state. So the idea of state is there, but the physical entity of state isn't there in the case of Kurds. And I think empirically this is very interesting, and I think it poses a different challenge to IR. The other aspect of it is the study of nationalism. Obviously, in IR, in my opinion, nationalism is very is studied in a very simplistic way. So not I don't think, especially when I started my PhD then. The very rich conversation in the nationalism studies around identity construction, the modernist perspectives, perennialist perspectives, and the different kind of explanations these theories provided on a variety of cases across the world, which explains the processes of state formation, World War One, post-World War One, Cold War, all those processes, with a very different lens, it's sociological, it's historical, it's political. So exploring that literature has been very informative for me. And it was very refreshing as well, coming from a very kind of traditional IR training. I also wanted to use the insights from the study of nationalism in my work and bring this discussion into IR to kind of open up the concept of nation, open up the concept of state and territory, and question these concepts through the tools that come from the study of nationalism and nations and ethnicity. So that's kind of my goal, and I think nationalism. So in a way, it's kind of became an eclectic study. But I wanted to also contribute to the study of the Kurdish politics. In the study of Kurdish politics, it's becoming much, there are lots of very valuable work has been produced on the Kurds. especially in the last 15 years, 20 years. And this literature is getting richer and richer, and more people from different disciplines are working on the Kurds, which is brilliant. But it's still, you know, the majority of the work on the Kurds, you know, looks at a narrower focus in terms of geographically or historically, you know, periodically, and usually it's some of most of the work is more micro level, this big picture. And the long-term study of the Kurds is mainly, you know, very classical, traditional, historical account of the Kurds and their activities and their political activities. So I wanted to go a little bit beyond that and look at this case from a more theoretical perspective, you know, and kind of use this case to create a bit of a more theoretical discussion, which I think, you know, a Kurdish case has a lot to offer to these theoretical discussions around identity formation and state formation and so on and so forth. And then I think these debates have a lot to offer to Kurdish studies. And, you know, well, basically that's what I wanted to do. So I wanted to kind of build bridges in my own way between these different fields. Which was difficult because I had to go through so much literature and so many debates. Several times on the way, I lost my way because I didn't know where it was going. It was just too much to bring in because the scope was big. Historically, it was a long-term period, geographically, a very wide region, but also intellectually, conceptually, theoretically, I was delving into so many different things. And I was worried about the work being superficial and you know, general because of that, because you know, you're just doing too much type of thing, but I also wanted to keep that, you know, big picture side of things and focus on the idea of territory and how this has been shaped in the Kurdish case in relation to the wider international processes, changes in the notions of legitimacy, state formation, so on and so forth, because usually Kurdish politics is studied without much connection to the international processes. And if it's studied in that context, it's usually in the context of, you know, foreign policy or more kind of classical foreign relations kind of perspective rather than more theoretical IR discussions. So that's what I try to do, basically.
Yes, definitely. And also you make it very clear that you try to also link Kurdish nationalism to international normative frameworks. That's also another challenge, I think. But you did a very good job in the book, and I'm very happy to have you today. But I would like to also go deeper, a little more deeper into the theoretical contributions that you make here in this book. And it's obvious that a theoretical contribution is not the only one that you make, because you also connect politics on the ground to certain historical processes, and you show us how it evolves over time. But I'm really curious, especially about the argument that you make here, and I want to share this with our audience now. Like, how do you think your argument and theoretical framework in this book reshape our understanding of the relationship between territory, state, Kurds, but also Kurdish nationalism?
Eat stress-free this spring with Factor's delicious ready-to-eat meals. Every fresh, never-frozen meal is chef-crafted, dietitian-approved, and ready to eat in just 2 minutes. Choose from a weekly menu of 35 options, including popular options like Calorie Smart, Keto, Protein Plus, or Vegan and Veggie. Get chef-prepared meals on the table in 2 minutes with Factor's ready-to-eat meals, so you can go back to doing what you love this spring. Looking for gourmet meals? Try meals that feature premium ingredients like filet mignon, shrimp, truffle butter, broccolini, and asparagus. And this is the part I really like. No fuss, no mess meals. Factor meals eliminate the hassle of prepping, cooking, or cleaning. You simply heat and savor the good stuff. Factor is the solution for fast premium meals without the need for cooking. Head to factormeals.com
NBN50 and use code NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box. That's code NBN50 at factormeals.com/NBN50 to get 50% off your first box plus 20% off your next box while your subscription is active.
I wouldn't want to make the bold claim of reshaping. I think my contribution is a very humble contribution to these discussions. So I wouldn't want to. I think it's just basically I wanted to open a discussion on these issues and question these things more without, I guess. Not going into the very much, what is right and what is wrong, does Kurdistan exist or not? I wanted to go beyond these questions. I'm not saying these questions are invaluable or shouldn't be discussed, anything like that. Nothing like that, of course. But coming from my own kind of background and story of for identity formation, and I think as individuals, we have a lot more autonomy about our identity. So we are not born into it, in my opinion. We are not determined by where we are born and our blood and blah, 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 all those traditional nationalist kind of conceptions of identity. And it mainly comes from my background because, being born in Eastern Turkey, I have a very mixed ethnic background. I grew up not necessarily really thinking about identity that much. So I was, my mom is Circassian. She has Kurdish family, and my dad, Turkish, Croatian, and then also some Armenian also in the mix. So it's a bit of everything, and lots of people, I think, in that part of the world and in anywhere, our identities are so layered and mixed and multidimensional. And there's also the element of, our own individual realizations of ourselves. So therefore, in the case of Kurdish nationalism, I wanted to kind of go beyond these, debates around that, and then kind of really try to understand, the idea of Kurdishness, the idea of Kurdistan and territory, without necessarily falling into this, are you pro-Kurdish? Are you non-pro-Kurdish? Because our field is very much dominated by these debates as well, like in any other field. That politically, it's a very sore subject for many people, including me. It's an ongoing issue. So intellectually engaging with these issues is always jarring, and is not easy emotionally and otherwise. So I'm aware of these things. It's kind of that was basically trying to understand, What is territory? What is this link between nation and territory, or people and territory? Where does it come from? And then how is it shaped by the international processes? Kind of almost trying to show, in any case, in any territory, whether it's a state territory or not, whether it has a historical background or not, it doesn't matter. No territorial conception, no territorial identity is natural. Whether it's a state territory or not. So that's kind of my take on the question.
Yes, yes. And also you use the map of Greater Kurdistan as an example to unpack your argument, I think, and show different minor points in the argument. And because you also say that political maps have the power to influence our imaginations, and I definitely agree with that. But it's interesting to see that the map of Kurdistan is not only used by Kurds, but also scholars. So that's another important point that you make. But towards the end, when I was reading the book, I also saw that you make another statement, which I find thought-provoking. You say intra-group divisions among Kurds can be considered as a strength because Kurdish actors benefit from different circumstances. And also they can take advantage of that. However, I have some reservations with that. I'm really curious about your elaboration. What are the main barriers to Kurdish unity? And how do you think that marginalized groups can take advantage of this unity, of the existing situation, current international system, which is still state-centered?
No, you're absolutely right. So that's kind of it came as an afterthought so there is no discussion on that, as you probably saw in the rest of the book. It was kind of a like post elaboration and discussion. But I was thinking of this a lot during, right when I was writing the section, the chapter on colonization and Kurdistan. And in those debates, and also World War I period as well. So the Kurdish political actors were not given the chance to form their own state. And one of the biggest criticisms that was directed towards them was that they are not unified. They don't have a common kind of leadership, political leadership. There are different groups, there are different languages, and et cetera, et cetera. You know, the classical debate about the dividedness of the Kurdish identity and et cetera. And I think this is a very paternalistic and arrogant view of a nation, of a group of people, and seeing the divisions as something to be criticized. Because, I mean, when you look at this is coming from more of different nationalism studies, when you look at any state, in the world of nation states, no state has a unified kind of nationality. The fact that states are saying we are all British, we are all Turkish, we are all this and that doesn't mean that actually officially that might be the case. But when you look into the social structure and the society itself and its history, its languages, you know, its political issues and geographic locations and everything, actually, there is no unification. There is no unitedness in that sense that we consider what nation is. So it just basically said by that point actually tries to say that, you know, this, you know, the artificial nature of this ideas of nation and the perceptions about unity are actually just perceptions, in my opinion, you know, and they gloss over the richness and the dividedness, which is not necessarily a bad thing, because this, you know, the nation has to be united is a myth that has been, I think, promoted in this nation state process. So I see where you're coming from when you say, you know, where in a marginalized group, in a group of people, for a group of people who want to attain statehood or recognition internationally. So, you know, it doesn't create a contradiction. That wasn't my aim. I wasn't, I'm not trying to say that, you know, they should not, you know, there is no point about they should not be united or they should be united. It's not about that. It's about mainly a frustration with the constant reminder in the Kurdish historiography by external people about the nature of the divided nature of the Kurdish identity and seeing this as a weakness. So I wanted to kind of challenge that external view of the Kurds. And I think it's what I mean with advantages. I don't know in the long term what will happen, but I think this rich context has enabled the Kurdish political actors to be very flexible and adjust to the new circumstances, you know, make new alliances and somehow survive very difficult and challenging political processes and contexts throughout the 20th century, you know, 19th century and today. So that's what I meant with, you know, give strength, because it gives them as political actors more kind of flexibility and adaptability.
So that they can also navigate around very difficult situations, maybe.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly what I meant.
But also, this is, of course, one way of reading it. But on the other hand, it will maybe bring its own crisis. So that's why Kurds are trying to deal with that in full force, even if they also continue to fight each other. This brings us to the next question. And you, it's about Syrian war, the case of Rojava. You also use that example, and you also offer us many other examples in the book. That's why I find it rich. So you argue that the Syrian war itself increased the competition between Kurdish parties, but also increased cooperation. Can you please tell us how this dual process has been working on the ground?
Mm-hmm. So I think in the case of, so like if you talk about, you know, competition and rivalry is a very, you know, as you know very well, it's a common theme in the Kurdish political historiography. And I think the Syrian case pretty much brought up very different two political agendas that are prominent in the contemporary Kurdish political arena. The KRG model, if you like, and the PKK model. And they have very different political positions, ideologies, you know, understandings of what a political system should look like, et cetera, and et cetera. And KRG adopts a more kind of traditional nation-state model, whereas PKK challenges. This is a much more radical kind of model. And I think with the Syrian case, more people became aware of the political kind of arguments that are made by the PKK's project. And the divisions became, you know, became more obvious for each group as well, particularly when they were trying to have more kind of political leverage in what was happening in northern Syria and have an influence that process. So KRG was, especially KDP, mm-hmm. was trying to do that for the PKK. So there was also like that kind of competition going on between them over shaping what was happening in northern Syria, in Rojava. So so that was the competition side of things. And obviously there are many more examples to this, but this is mainly that. And I don't want to take more of your time with this. But in terms of cooperation, I think there are elements of cooperation, like, you know, military cooperation, support, especially during the conflict when ISIS attacked the Yazidis, for instance. You know, what how several groups, military groups, cooperated and coordinated with each other to support the Yazidis, and you know, in that process. YPG forces played a key role. And then in the case of Kobani is another one. So that's kind of the more military, more physical cooperation. But what I think I wanted to emphasize in that context more the sense of solidarity and the sense of connectedness with the other Kurds across the borders, I think, increased. In the case of Kobani, for especially, is a key case. I think it's a really important event, I think, in the Kurdish history, in national history, nationalism history, and the history of nationalism. So it's kind of, but with cooperation, I think it's more than cooperation, the sense of connectedness, sense of shared suffering and sense of shared political goal or connectedness in terms of, I think that was very prominent in my opinion, because Kurds from different political backgrounds, ideological positions and so on and so forth, you know, felt connected, I think. You know, I don't want to talk on behalf of how they felt, because it's not my position to do that. I wouldn't claim to say this is what Kurds feel or they do. But at least, you know, talking to friends, talking to people, and reading the newspapers and conversations, there was definitely, I think, a clearly observable sense of connectedness and solidarity in that process.
Definitely. And the other question is if it's going to be sustainable or not, and what are the other challenges. And I think that's what you're trying to do also in this example, or it's my reading that you also try to show us these controversies. So it means that there's not only one way out of the picture, right? So that's why it was also interesting to see how competition grows together with cooperation and connectedness, as you said, at the same time. So Zeynep, I have two more questions before we go. I also don't want to take so much of your time. So I'm really curious about this question now that I will ask. If you had a chance to go back, what would you add onto your analysis of territory and self-determination?
Oh, it's so much stuff I would like to add. what would be the most? I think one of the I would have loved to add more kind of insights from the publications that are produced in Turkey, in Syria, in Iraq, in Iran, by Kurdish or non-Kurdish scholars, but, you know, basically scholars who live in the region and who produce those works, more kind of historical works as well. I think I would have loved to do that. The thing is that because I had to look into so many different literatures and explore so many different ideas. I was really processing too much information. So it just, but there was never enough time for anything. So if I was to go back, I would have wanted to spend more time doing that. And the other thing I would have liked to do was to spend more time in the archives. Especially I found the colonial period, early 20th century period, really fascinating. And I learned how to read Ottoman, the old language with Arabic alphabet. So I wanted to go to the archives and read the resources there. But again, never enough time because, you know, like as you know, PhD is just 4 years. And life happens, you know, I had a daughter, a, you know, three-year-old girl. And I was also, supporting myself financially, you know, teaching and trying to do a PhD. So working like almost full time, doing a PhD, having a child, going through a divorce. So it's just like, you know, life just gets in the way of so much stuff that you want to do. If I was to go back, I would have liked to have more time and explore those, especially those two sources more and incorporate them into the analysis.
Yes, thank you. Of course, learning Ottoman is not easy task, I think, but here, I think in this book, you achieved something more difficult than that. And I don't want to underestimate anyone's contribution. Here in this book, you use historical materials to make us understand and to explain some normative questions, which is quite rare in the literature, in the scholarship, actually, because most of the historians, I think, they know history well, they know how to read archives. But when it comes to these kind of ongoing discussions in IR or in other fields of political science, we don't see many people who can do both, right? So that's why I think I strongly recommend everyone to read the book so we can have more exchange on the book, and we can also learn more from each other. So the final question, Zeynep, again, this is coming from the personal side of me. I'm really curious whether you have any suggestions or advice for PhD students or other scholars interested in similar topics such as Kurds, Kurdistan, history, international relations, political geography, and so forth.
I think intellectually, I think one of the things that are interesting to explore is these, you know, how Kurdish political actors and Kurdish politics on the ground is contributing to the change in the Middle East, in the region, and internationally, you know, challenging or contributing to these ideas around nationalism, territory, politics, democracy, human rights, you know. So there is a lot of, you know, like any case is very rich, so is the Kurdish case. But the Kurdish case is particularly rich because it's situated in a very interesting long-term historical context, you know, the Ottoman and post-Ottoman World War I processes, the nature, you know, the politics of the Middle East, that history, and then four different nation states. And then the Kurds as a marginalized group, you know, the discussions around it is embedded in democracy and human rights and several aspects. It's a case that can contribute immensely into wider debates in the literature, on in IR or in political geography or history, and I think you know, like more kind of theoretical conceptual discussions on building on this empirical case would be fascinating to see. That was something I was really I really wanted to see in the when I was, you know, reading the books on the Kurds and articles on the Kurds. I wasn't able to find too much, you know, conceptual theoretical you know, things to kind of, you know, dig my teeth into and then explore. That would be great to do that in the long term. The other thing I would say, it's a lot of, you know, it's a very sensitive topic. There is a lot of, you know, personal, you know, what's that called? That I found the whole PhD process sometimes emotionally difficult. You know, there's a lot of like boundaries and divisions and polarizations that happens in any political issue, and these are very, you know, obviously that's kind of what makes discussions very rich and important. But then this sometimes comes with a personal cost, and you know, this, you know, and hinders conversation and interaction and dialogue sometimes, in my opinion. And this is the case, I think, in many politically sensitive issues, so as well as in the case of the Kurds. So I would suggest to PhD students in the future to kind of, you know, talk to anyone, whatever their background is or their intellectual position is or their ideological political position is, you know. And there is a lot to be discussed in that you know, intellectual dimension as well. You know, keeping the dialogue open, keeping the conversation open, so that the Kurdish, you know, the literature on the Kurds progresses, you know, more quickly and grows even more than it is now.
I completely agree. And also I hope young people, especially emerging scholars and the youth, especially Kurdish youth, will also find this podcast inspiring, Zeynep. Thank you very much for your time. I was very happy to have you today as our first guest for the Kurdish Studies series of New Books Network.
Thank you, Dilan, for having me on board, and thank you very much for your kind words on my book. And it was lovely to talk to you, and wishing you all the best for the podcast going forward.
Thank you very much, Zeynep.